Today in Studio 360, plenty of people can't stand her, but lots of young musicians worship her. And at 76, she's the most famous avant-garde artist alive.
Kiss, 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 kiss me, love.
Yoko Ono.
Just one kiss, kiss will do.
Her new album, produced with her son Sean Lennon, is Between My Head and the Sky.
It's a long, long story to tell.
And later, we enter another musical galaxy altogether with the composer Marvin Hamlisch.
Once I started and got the idea of I'm going with happy-go-lucky guy and everybody else is nuts, this just comes to you.
He tells us about scoring the new Steven Soderbergh movie, The Informant, with Matt Damon as the whistleblower who isn't all he seems. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. John Lennon once said that Yoko Ono was the world's most famous unknown artist. Everybody knows her name, but nobody knows what she does.
Magic!
I'm not sure that's true any longer, but it is true that her art has usually existed outside the mainstream. But now, at the age, startlingly, of 76, Yoko Ono is creating work that is popping up in an unexpected place, the world of dance music. During the past couple of years, groovy young artists like DJ Spooky have remixed her songs, and she's had five, count them, five number one hits on the club charts. She's just released an album of original music with a newly formed Plastic Ono band. It is called Between My Head and the Sky, and she produced it with her son, Sean Lennon. It's gotten what may be the best reviews of her career.
That's true. That's really true, Kurt.
Yoko Ono, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So, what was it like working with your son on this record?
Well, first of all, when he asked me to do it, I said, okay. And I just didn't have any, qualms about it. But then my friends were all saying, why did you do that? Don't do it. Don't do it. Mother and son, that's very bad, you know. Then I got nervous. But actually, my first instinct was right. It was very good.
On your website, which is called Imagine Peace, you wrote a lovely essay, actually, about making this record with Sean. And you describe something that happened while you were taking a nap in the studio. Can you tell that story?
And it was a very strange thing that happened because, you know, we take turns to sort of lie down on the couch, you know, because it's just a long night or something. So I was on the couch sort of closing my eyes. And then suddenly somebody put a coat on me, you know.
As a blanket.
As a blanket. And John used to do that when we were making Double Fantasy. So it's just in my sort of like sleepy head, you know. I wasn't sure whether, he said, well, that was John, but, and I just opened my eyes and it was Sean. Which is amazing. Exactly the same army surplus coat, but John's was a little bit softer and Sean's was a little bit harder, I think.
And he's now as old as John was when you got together, I guess.
Oh, my God. I didn't think about that. That's true. It's amazing.
Were there funny moments while you were working on this record?
Well, I mean, there were all sorts of moments. So what are you talking about?
Well, was it all serious business or did you become the mother and say, no, Sean, I don't want to do that?
Well, I try not to be too difficult.
Uh-huh.
But I'm a very difficult person.
Really?
Well, yeah. And then in terms of my work, you know, artwork and music work, I'm a perfectionist in a way. But this time I thought, no, I'm not going to be that control freak because, you know, I have to let him breathe too, you know, and try to be like Zen master or something, you know, one of those sort of, okay, I'm beyond that kind of thing. But, I got away with it.
The title track of the album, Between My Head and the Sky, is pretty rocking.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
But you see, I thought of that and I thought, good title.
Let's listen a little bit to that song.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's Yoko Ono's Between My Head and the Sky. As soon as that begins and you do your ululating thing that that one instantly recognizes as Yoko Ono, it made me think, when did that become a sort of signature vocal thing of yours and why?
When I was when I was very little, I was sort of plunked in my mother's summer house or something. And there was a servant's quarter, and my mother said, never go to the servant's quarter because they'll be talking about something that you should not know. And of course you want to go there, you know, when somebody says that. So I sneaked up, and there were two young girls talking about my aunt just had a baby, and she was going, and it was really frightening. And I never forgot that sound. And I was thinking, well, you know, the male society is always sort of asking women to be pretty, young, and sweet. And the voice in the songs usually is very sweet, you know. But then I thought, but we're the ones who actually created a human race. I mean, without us, you won't be here. Excuse me.
Vice versa.
Well, not really.
Really? You can do it without us?
I think so.
Okay, well.
But anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah. I mean, I'm just talking about that.
But that's where that was the genesis of that.
Yeah, and I thought, I want to really break, you know, the sound barrier to show that the woman has a strong voice too.
Uh-huh.
If we didn't have a strong voice, I mean, we couldn't have created the human race.
Right. Your work keeps on influencing people. So artists like the B-52s, Sonic Youth. On this record of yours, you worked with these super cool Japanese musicians.
They're really super cool.
Yuka Honda and Cornelius.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, by the way, I just want to go back to it and say, uh-huh. No, I didn't mean that we don't need men. I think it's nice to have men around.
Good. I'm glad you've conceded that.
Okay.
two very cutting-edge female musicians, Cat Power and Peaches, have done remixes of your songs. As that happens, does it make you think about the experience of a woman artist today, women of their age versus when you started out?
Well, you know, the thing is, the women's plight, so to speak, is still there. And I go to all the different countries and they usually say, would you please come to the women's meeting? And I do go. And it's really a very serious problem still,
right.
Especially in the Middle East. And I think that the reason is because there's a strong backlash.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's listen to the Peaches remix of Kiss, 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 which was originally on your 1980 album with John Lennon, Double Fantasy. Kiss, 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 you and Peaches. What do you think of her version?
I think it's great. What I did then was kind of pretty good then, but I think that this is newer. It's very nice. Yeah.
That record of remixes is called Yes, I'm a Witch.
Yes.
Which makes me think you have a good sense of humor about the crap and flack you've taken over the years.
Yeah, you know, I just feel like saying, yes, I'm a witch, you know, because they were really trying to persecute me and put me on a cross. So I said, well, okay, so I am a witch.
Your art installation piece called Wish Tree has now been shown at galleries all over the world. Tell me about that.
Wish Tree is just a tree, and you just write your wish and put it on the tree, you see. And it's a pretty strange...
In Japan, I've seen that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. When you go to a temple and you pay 10 yen, you get a little paper that says, love will be given to you, money will be given to you, and long life will be given to you or something. And it's all printed, you know. And you take that and you just put it on the bush. Now, I thought it's much nicer. It's a huge, beautiful tree, and you're free of what you want to write. And once when I did in Spain... all these people of that town who never been to a museum before. I would never enter a museum because they think, oh, it's something
fancy.
Yeah,
and
yeah. And all the sort of working class people all lined up to put the wishes on the tree. And that's when I created the Imagine Peace Tower.
Uh-huh.
And all the wishes go to the Imagine Peace Tower.
So they're not just tossed out?
No, they're not tossed out.
On Between My Head and the Sky, there are some dance songs, but most of the music is pretty thoughtful and low-key. I want to play an example. This is called Unanto.
Unanto, yes.
Let's listen.
In a day, sometimes I feel so much love for the world. Think my heart is bursting. Sometimes I feel so scared. I want to shrink myself even further. Don't ever give up on life. Life can be so beautiful, especially after you've spent a lot of years with it. Because then, life becomes like a lover you have been close to. You know him so well, and yet every day he gives you a surprise. When you say, I love you, remember you're not just saying it to the one you love, you're saying to yourself, the planet, and the universe.
That's a very lovely and wise lyric. Tell me where that song came from.
Just between my head and the sky.
Yeah? out of your hat.
Out of my hat, right. Unanto. Unanto.
And what are you working on right now?
I'm now working on talking to you.
I appreciate that. Yoko Ono, thank you very much.
It was nice talking to you.
Yoko Ono's new album is called Between My Head and the Sky, and you can hear a track from it at studio360.org. Coming up...
You want it to be that pastiche. You want it to be that over-the-top. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know, here we are in the lounge, El Capri, with your fat... You know what you're doing? And here he is singing, Trust Me, Bobby, Dutka-baka-pataka. Trust me, hey!
The singularly sensational Marvin Hamlisch. I'm Kurt Anderson. That's ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In just a couple of weeks, 14 artists and 3 scientists from 9 different countries are going to set off to explore the waters of the Arctic. They'll be aboard a 100-year-old 2-masted schooner. They'll start from a frozen archipelago midway between Norway and the North Pole, and then travel north collecting data and trying to make some art at sea. KCRW's Matt Holzman is packing his bags to go with them.
The Arctic, and that's the one north with the polar bears, not the penguins, it has to be like no other place on Earth.
You can look across at a beach and see something that you think is a hut, and yet when you get there, maybe it's a wooden crate, or vice versa, the other way around. It's very hard. There's nothing to scale things off against.
Dan Harvey and his wife and fellow artist Heather Ackroyd have already sailed the Arctic waters with groups of artists and scientists. That includes a voyage on the ship that will be my home for 2 weeks, the aptly named Noorderlicht, Northern Lights in Dutch.
The air is incredibly clean. I mean, a lot of us were almost experiencing a euphoria.
Heather and Dan told me truly amazing stories from the Arctic. But honestly, it's pretty hard to imagine. And everyone who's headed north with me seems prepared to be unprepared.
No one knows what's really going to happen there.
Osman Khan is an American artist who's done pieces made of discs of ice. He calls them polar bear life rafts.
And another project would be to sort of tether broken ice parts back onto the main ice shelf. We'll see. I'm now far more open to what might happen.
With the polar ice cap melting, we all have climate change somewhere in our consciousness. But the Farm Foundation, the small artists residency program that organized this trip, didn't even mention global warming in their brochure. They didn't want to set any agenda. So when they host what they hope will be the first of many shows in Miami a month after we return, it's hard to know exactly what we'll see.
I know how I will start to do it and what tools I take with, but the actual happenings, I don't know.
Finnish artist Heini Aho works a lot with video, but she's from relatively warm southern Finland, so she's worried about her equipment in the cold.
Yeah, I have to be prepared with these old batteries, how to preserve them. Otherwise, you go outside and I don't know how to say it in English.
Janet Biggs is based in New York.
I wanted to choreograph a kayak ballet in Arctic waters.
She's already contacted a kayak team in Norway and will fly out early to work with them. But you know what they say, the best laid schemes of men, mice, and artists.
I had a kayak lesson today in the Hudson and realized, okay, I'm getting seasick in a kayak. This does not bode well for my sailing experience in the Arctic. I'm investing in Dramamine, Long Johns and Dramamine. That's where most of my grant money is going right now.
Even the veteran sailors going on this trip brought up seasickness, pun intended. It seems like everybody's worried about seasickness, including Canadian Sarah Ann Johnson.
I get motion sickness in a car. But wouldn't that be hilarious if I was super insanely sick the whole time and then I would just make art about that? Well, it wouldn't be funny while it was happening. 2 weeks after, then it would be funny.
Before she left on her first trip, Heather Ackroyd worried that it would be one long heave in every sense of the word. That's a quote. And part of her trip was exactly that. But her husband, Dan, just rolled with it, literally.
I did a series on the really rough crossing, just allowing this ball to be soaked in ink and roll across the paper so that the whole sort of motion of the ship did these drawings.
I asked Heather for her advice on how to make the trip successful, artistically, scientifically, and every other way. And she said, this is very deep, warm feet.
Really dry socks. The other thing is very good hand cream. It's very dry. So, you know, you want to make sure that your skin's very moisturized, Matt.
But for the group preparing for its voyage on the Norderlicht, it's not dry hands or cold feet or throwing up or being eaten by polar bears that's the big concern. It's the other artists. Remember, there'll be 14 of them and their stuff on a 150-foot ship for 2 weeks. That's less than 10 feet per artist.
As long as there's no wanker, I don't see any real problem.
Ian Burns is an Australian artist who's apparently participated in one too many artist residencies over the years.
One wanker can certainly sour the bunch. I guess we could always walk the plank with someone.
The plank was mentioned by a full third of the artists I talked to for this story, but Arctic veteran Heather Ackroyd insists that neither the plank nor the lash nor the brig will be required for this trip.
What we actually found was an incredible bonding with the other people that we were with. I think there was a real deep kind of communion that went on, you know, and in spite of, you know, artists' reputation for being quite solitary creatures, we were all very bonded by that experience.
To me, anyway, the Arctic sort of enters you a bit like a shard of ice, and it never thaws out once that's in there. It's something that, I think it's life-changing.
For Studio 360, I'm Matt Holzman on my way to the Arctic Circle.
And we'll get a full report from Matt after he returns from the voyage. For almost half a century, Marvin Hamlisch has made his way into our heads with ballad after show-stopping ballad. What I Did for Love from A Chorus Line, Through the Eyes of Love from Ice Castles, and The Way We Were. But that's just scratching the surface. Add to the list dozens of movie scores, plus one of the better James Bond theme songs. His latest work is the terrific score for the Steven Soderbergh movie The Informant. Matt Damon plays Mark Whitaker, a real-life corporate whistleblower. Back in the 1990s, Whitaker helped the FBI expose a big price-fixing scandal at an agribusiness company. But he's not at all a straight-ahead hero. And to talk about that and his brilliant career, Marvin Hamlisch is with me today. Welcome to Studio 360.
Wow, what? Now that's an intro. That is an intro.
We could have gone on.
My gosh. Whew. I'm feeling either old or dead.
So The Informant is the first film you've done in like a dozen years.
Yes, right.
What drew you back?
You know, just you thought it was safe, and just when you thought it was safe, they pull you back.
Right.
Well, first of all, I have to be honest with you. One of the chief things that did it was I get a phone call directly from Steven Soderbergh. I was an absolute, you know, like, wow. And he took me to lunch and explained to me that he had this film and that he used as the temporary track for the film music from Bananas, which was my third film that I did.
The Woody Allen movie.
The Woody Allen movie. And he said what he loved about it was he loved the energy of it, and he wanted to basically have me do the music for this film, this Matt Damon film. So I went to see it, which I loved. It's a very interesting film because the protagonist is a bipolar person. Okay, now
among other problems,
amongst other problems, but that's the key problem. And the thing was that for 2 weeks, I am not kidding you when I tell you, you know, when you're working on a score for a film, you try to figure out first how you get in, the key to the door of getting into the film. Once you're in, it's actually much easier than you think it is to score. And for the first 2 weeks, you know, you have the television monitor, I have it on my piano, because in the words of Michelangelo, who supposedly said when they asked him, how do you make an elephant, he said, I get a slab of concrete, I take away everything that's not an elephant, I'm left with an elephant. So in the same way, I figured, okay, let me start trying. Well, everything that I would put to it didn't do it for me. It didn't satisfy me, and it didn't make me laugh. All of a sudden, I'm walking in the streets of New York, and it dawns on me that I'm thinking of this all wrong. I've got to start thinking of it the way the main character would be thinking. And the way, if you take it from his point of view, it turns out that he is just having the best time of his life, and the FBI are nuts.
Well, let's play a clip that illustrates, right, I think, exactly what you're talking, right, about. This is the Matt Damon character, Mark Whitaker, who is meeting with his FBI, right, agent handler for the first time, and we hear then one of his inner monologues.
Now, I have been in several meetings with our Japanese and Korean competitors over the last few months where the sole purpose was to fix the prices. ADM made me go to those meetings. So if you figure out the price-fixing thing, I'd be the fall guy. He seems like a real good guy. I hope he doesn't mind me calling him Brian instead of Agent Shepard. I might even try Bri out. This must be very different for him, talking to a guy like me instead of a bank robber or a drug dealer. I could see us fishing or whatever. What a good listener. You don't meet one of those every day.
And now, and there's your happy theme.
Well, exactly, and right, and it so works. And I've never been as conscious of music actually making comedy work as well as it does in this film.
Well, I thank you. The truth was, once I started and got the idea of I'm going with happy-go-lucky guy and everybody else is nuts, this just comes to you. Now, this is not what you call music that's going to be hidden somewhere. You know, this is not this kind of music.
No, it's very foreground.
It's very foreground. I'll tell you a very sweet story about foreground. This has never happened in my life, okay? We went to see the premiere in New York City. At the party, I saw Steven, and I embraced him and said, thank you for this opportunity. And his wife told me that after the first 5 minutes of the film, he went upstairs to the projectionist and said, give me more music. You know, I want it louder. Nobody does that. You know?
Was it interesting for you, a guy who, because you started literally when you were a child, no, right, joke, at writing music for movies, you were working in the early 60s.
Right, oh yeah.
Then to do this sort of ironic pastiche of,
right, yeah,
60s for,
yeah,
this film?
Easy for me. Very, yeah, easy. I was there. You know? I was there. So yes, it was a simple thing to do.
You have written plenty of jaunty songs, yes, and scores. You also, in film, did the scores for serious movies like Ordinary, yes, People and Sophie's,
oh, yeah,
Choice.
Oh, yeah.
Is that an entirely different Marvin Hamlisch head that does,
right,
those kinds of films?
In fact, the way I try to explain it to people is, think of my brain, the music part of my brain, as a cassette machine. And all you keep doing is, depending on what the movie is, you change the rules of the cassette. So you change the cassette. You say, no, we're going to do a beautiful theme with sadness. There it is. You know, we're going to do a theme about, you know, and you just, you literally have to take in, look, it's the same
way. I want you all here all the time just playing behind the show.
If you've ever been at the United Nations, you know how that moment comes, it's so great, where someone's speaking in, I don't know, Hungarian. They're speaking in Hungarian, and you hear the person say, and now, with a simultaneous interpretation, right? A translation, they say. Simultaneous translation, and you put on the headset. Well, if you think of music as a language, all I'm doing is taking my thoughts in English. Well, this should be funny. This should be this. This should really get you. This should really hurt. This should, you know, and translating what I'm feeling about a scene into music.
And I guess you're so fluent at that. I mean, it's almost what psychologists call synesthesia, right? Where words go right. Directly into music.
Exactly, right. Definitely.
You've been doing this, film scoring, for 40 years.
Yep.
Is the process any different now than it was in 1967?
I used to work at home on a moviola. Now, a moviola makes an incredible amount of noise.
Those are those old-fashioned editing tables.
Tables. So. And you hear... I mean, you're trying to write a music, and you're hearing... like that. Well, not only are you hearing it, but your neighbor's hearing it, you know? And it's a huge machine, and people would go crazy. And, you know, it was horrible. I remember all these films that I used to work on. We worked on the print that was in black and white. I mean, the way we were, writing a beautiful number for the way we were in black and white is not the easiest thing in the world. So in those respects, it's wonderful. I have to tell you, I'm still of the old school. I still write with a pen or a pencil. I don't use synthesizers that much. I use them, but I don't use them that much. Like I always say, I'm not here to paint white on a white wall. I'm here to put salt and pepper on something. You know what I mean? Some directors, I have to say, like a Steven Soderbergh, wants to put that music out there. He liked it. A George Roy Hill, you know, who did The Sting, he liked it, you know? Other directors want you to basically be a carpet, meaning we don't really know it's a carpet. We don't even look at the carpet.
But it has to be there.
But it feels good.
The Sting, George Roy Hill... from 1973. Now, people would not know Scott Joplin
right.
or Ragtime probably generally were it not for you reaching into the vaults. And
right. But actually, before I reached into the vault, the person who's really responsible is the son of George Roy Hill, because it's the son of George Roy Hill who kept playing Ragtime at home. And George Roy Hill said, "What is that?" And what George Roy Hill loved about this music is the same exact thing that Soderbergh loved about Bananas. He said, "I love the energy of this music, and I love that it has a twinkle in its eye." So here's the deal. Sometimes this happens in life. Ready? It's 5 o'clock at night. It's raining in New York City. You know you're never going to get a cab, right? You know it. It's raining in New York, 5 o'clock, you might as well forget it. I always used to say, if you're going from the east side to the west side, you better be born there because you're not going to get a cab. You walk outside, and all of a sudden, a woman steps out of a cab, and you get the cab, right? I mean, it's like, how did that happen, right? It happens. In the same way, let me tell you what happened. So I go to the library in L.A., the music library, and I pick out everything of Scott Joplin. I'm talking about every piece of music that Scott Joplin ever wrote. I put them all in front of me, and I go in and I actually pick my favorite moments. I go, I like this, I don't like this, I like this, I don't like this, right?
From records or from actual
sheet music? Sheet music. And I'm not kidding you when I tell you that the actual doing this film maybe took me 6 days. Because, like the woman who steps up, everything fit. It was like, you know... It was like... perfect. It was like as if they had made the movie after they heard the music, you know? So now you can't call up a studio and say, I've just done this.
You got to wait a few weeks to make it look hard.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So 3 weeks later, they say, how's it going? I said, well, you know, this baby is really tough. But I'm muddling through, you know, as I'm sitting out there going, another, daiquiri, please. But what happened was it was an amazing thing. The things that I did in the film that I'm proud of, that I'm really proud of, but people don't know. But, you know, this theme.
Which is Scott, the famous theme, yeah.
That's Scott Joplin. But what I put on next to it was mine, which went...
Oh, so you actually improved it.
Yeah, I don't know about improved it. I just added that because I wanted that melancholy solo violin. And there was a couple of things I wrote for the film, but... it was amazing. I mean, every time I would say to myself, all right, I'm going to give 2 hours to this scene. I'm going to work on it. 20 minutes later, I go, I can't believe it. It's done. And I would look at it and say, is this possible? But, you know, when something is bound to work, it just works.
Back before you did any of this, you were studying music at the age of 5 and became the youngest person ever admitted to Juilliard at 7 or something. Your first hit was, you weren't much older.
No.
You were 21. It was Leslie Gore saying, "Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows."
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny. When you're near, the rain goes, disappears, dear, and I feel so fine. Just to know that you are mine. That's enough, right?
And 44 years later,
yeah,
as it happens, that song, of course, is in this week's huge box office smash.
Which is it?
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
That song's in there?
You didn't know that?
I had no idea.
So you're competing with yourself.
Oh, my God.
And you didn't even know it. In fact, you beat yourself.
Oh, my God.
That was the number one movie, and The Informant was the number two movie.
Well, at least it's there. That's what counts.
But here you are. You're a successful musician. You've been to Juilliard. You're 19 years old when the Beatles come.
Right.
You're in your 20s as the 60s are happening. Did you feel out of sync with your generation?
Always. I've always felt out of sync. In fact, I still feel out of sync, and I'll tell you why. I grew up with parents who were from Vienna. My father was Viennese, schooled in Vienna. The fact that we don't even have an arts minister drove him crazy about America. He couldn't believe it. He just couldn't believe he was in the country without an arts minister. You can tell in the fourth grade that I'm out of it, because in the fourth grade, I still have my picture of the fourth grade picture, you know, with the class. I'm the only one wearing a tie. Now, why is that? I never did the bar scene. I never did the pills and the liquor. It wasn't my thing.
But you didn't like, you know, just rock and roll either.
Well, I liked rock and roll. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I loved it. Good night, sweet. I love that. I love dum 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 dum. I mean, I love the songs. The 60s, the Beatles were to die. But it was hard for me. You know, when you sit down at the piano and you try to write what we call like music, okay, what do you want to do? I want you to write a song like Henry Mancini. Well,
waiter,
yeah,
martini.
Right. You can do it, but you are not really writing what you would normally write. You're trying to sound like somebody. And I always felt I was out of it, because my father particularly always used to talk about, you got to write a good melody.
It's as though you came of it. You were this prodigy. You
right.
came of age at this moment. And that's the musical DNA that stuck. Right?
You're right. Exactly. My goal in life was to write a Broadway show before I was 30 years old. And I started taking jobs as a rehearsal pianist and things. You know, that's how I met Barbara Streisand on Funny Girl and other shows. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, because I did well in Hollywood, I get my phone call. The phone call I've been waiting for. Now, look, when you're 29 years old, you think you've been waiting 140 years. You know what I mean? I know it sounds ridiculous, but if you've been waiting for a phone call since you're about 11 years old, it's a long time. And it was Michael Bennett, who I certainly knew. And he said, come to New York. I have an idea for a show. And that turned out to be Chorus Line.
Chorus Line, the thing you're proudest of?
Yes, it is, definitely. I mean, because remember, when you're starting a show, you're one of the creators. You're not the person brought in after everybody else has done it and you go, now give me some music. You're from the very beginning. It was a great, first of all, it was great because all the people who worked on it, except for Michael, we were all novices. We were all just dying to do something great. And Broadway, for me, was the place where the serious composer who didn't want to write, who wanted to write a tune, you know? That was the place where you're going to do that. That's why Stephen Sondheim is a Broadway writer. Well, if you go to Broadway now these days, what you're hearing is more... You're hearing more of that stuff, and it's become a world of revivals, a world of shows that all come from England, a world of...
Disney animated soundtracks
on...
Yeah.
And a world of movies that now are shows. And... That depresses me.
There's
actually
less ambition, you're saying.
Oh, totally less. I mean, now, as I say, it's not show business anymore. It's the business of show. I mean, it's, and I have to tell you something. At $120 a pop, I want it to be great.
Before you go,
this is it. Goodbye.
As a we're getting to goodbye. As a personal request, could you play a little bit of more from the Sting? Maybe the song Solace.
Oh, sure. This is Solace, ladies and gentlemen. I always get into my radio voice. Well, thank you very much. This is Marvin Hamlisch on
PRI's Studio 360.
There you go.
Marvin Hamlisch, it has been an enormous pleasure having you here and hearing you play and talk.
Well, my pleasure, really. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, can we put it on now? Can we really run this thing now?
Yeah.
Can we put it in the record mode?
Marvin Hamlisch's new movie is called The Informant, and it's out now. We got Marvin to play a song from the movie, which you can hear at studio360.org. Coming up, love the novel but hate the ending?
What is happening under those bridges?
Yeah, exactly.
Of Madison
That's
County.
Why they're covered. That's why the bridges are covered.
Rewriting the Bridges of Madison County. I'm Kurt Anderson. That's ahead in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
All you suckers gather round. There's a brand new movie coming to town. So get on up and check the scene of the smoothest, baddest mother to ever hit the big screen. Main man, Black Dynamite.
There's a new movie coming out called Black Dynamite. It's sort of an homage to 70s blaxploitation movies.
You're so righteous.
This is also true.
And for the score, the filmmakers pulled all the songs from something called library music. Whether you know it or not, you've heard a ton of this stuff. It's like stock photos. And turns out, some of it is pretty good. Lawrence Lanahan talked to some record collectors and hip-hop producers who've been digging on library music for years.
Can you believe that the musician who created this is also responsible for this? Am I on hold? A composer named Nick Ingman recorded them both for DeWolf Music, a British music library. Library music companies produce tracks for future use in film, television, and yes, even for putting people on hold. It's basically canned music, but for the last few years, record collectors have been going nuts for songs like this one, that, for the most part, can only be found on library music LPs from the 1970s.
People started getting into them. It was pretty amazing. Like, people were just paying so much money, and they were so after them. And you know,
Ross Jensen is the manager of a record shop in New York City's Lower East Side that caters to serious record collectors and music producers, like the kind that'll drop a couple hundred bucks on a library album.
You know, because they were so unique, like records that were never released. You know, everybody was like, what? What's this?
Cool. What do you have in now?
Not so much right now, due to the demand of them. We have one pretty good one. That's Brute Music, Drama Montage, Volume 2. Also, the thing about sound libraries is that they always have descriptions next to the titles. So we got the Groovy City After Dark, the Successful Getaway. So, you know, they try to let you know what's going on before you listen to the record.
Music libraries still use descriptors like Groovy City After Dark. It helps people in the film and television industry find the background music they need.
The thing that usually separates a good music library from something that's just kind of standard is the depth of their search engine.
So that's Barry Cole, a music supervisor for Palm Pictures.
Happy or sad, big arrangement, solo instrument, night or day, you know, I mean, and it gets pretty deep.
Cole is responsible for the music in dozens of films. I asked him to show me how a library works. We kept in mind a scene featuring a newborn baby.
I'm doing a search for Lullaby. The search results have pulled in A Magical Moment, Gentle Music, A Heartfelt Lullaby That's Full of Love, Heartfelt Lullaby That's Full of Love, alternate version, A Gentle Sleepy Lullaby, Gentle and Dreamlike, Simple, Smooth and Tranquil, Smooth, Warm, Dreamy.
There's a whole century of library music like this. Today it's cheesy lullabies. 100 years ago, it was piano sheet music for silent movies. It's obviously not something you'd sit around and listen to. But something special was happening back in the mid-1970s. Jason Willett, a Baltimore musician and DJ, first heard library music from that era several years ago in Sydney, Australia, at a freaked-out dance party called Sounds of Seduction.
Immediately, I was sucked right into the center of that world. It was like this sort of strong destiny that I had with all of those people there. But I didn't really start to know more about library music until I came back to Baltimore and wanted to feel some sort of connection back to that place in Australia. I was missing it.
Willett recently went to New York and dug around DeWolf's 70s vinyl collection. He found enough songs to release a great compilation album on his small indie label. It's called Music DeWolf Volume 1.
I first went with my own feelings. What do I think is the most amazing thing that I'm getting out of this DeWolf archive right now? And so these are my personal favorites.
Willett says library music, just like pop music, got watered down when synthesizers and drum machines replaced real musicians.
I knew that my chances would be incredibly lowered if I went past, you know, say 1978 or 79.
Why is it only this mid-70s stuff that's so appealing? To find out, I went right to the source.
I mean, library music was a kind of Chinese meal. As soon as you did it, you kind of forgot about it, and you felt hungry again.
That's composer Nick Ingman, a star producer from 60s and 70s British library music.
In the early days, we just were told, you know, as I say, how many hours, how many musicians, and off you go and do your thing. Also, we had, at the time, the cream of the session guys in London. Jimmy Page joined Led Zeppelin, and I certainly used him on some library things.
You used Jimmy Page on library stuff?
Yeah, way, way back, yeah. He was just another guy. I mean, we used a piano player called Reg Dwight, and he became Elton John. So a lot of these guys were just jobbing musicians.
In the mid-1970s, a groundbreaking cop show called The Sweeney inspired the sound that would come to define this era's library music.
All the police dramas up to that point, the police were all very polite, you know, politically correct and all the things you wanted your mum to meet. And they were hard-drinking, hard-smoking, swearing people. And so the mood was quite different, and they wanted music to reflect that. I mean, the other thing we were hugely influenced by were people like Herbie Hancock, who was, you know, writing this jazz-funk stuff. We all listened to that and really, really assimilated that.
It's no surprise to hear British musicians were imitating American jazz funk. The Beatles and the Stones had done the same thing with blues and R&B 10 years earlier. But now hip-hop producers are turning the tables, as it were, and sampling British DeWolf tracks from the 1970s. This Jay-Z track, for instance, samples and speeds up this beat, which had languished for decades in DeWolf's vinyl collection in New York. And, of course, today's library music industry has already cashed in on hip-hop. Take a listen next time you watch a couple hours of TV. If you hear edgy beats and rhymes in the background, it just might be from DeWolf's new subsidiary, which is called, you know, Beats and Rhymes. For Studio 360, I'm Lawrence Lanahan.
Speaking of going back into the vaults, Ernest Hemingway's publisher, Scribner's, recently put out a new version of A Movable Feast, which is Hemingway's memoir about his years in Paris. This so-called restored edition was edited by Hemingway's grandson, Sean Hemingway. And it makes his grandmother, who was Mrs. Hemingway number two, seem more likable than she did in the book as it was originally published back in 1964. Sean also added new chapters that mention the size of F. Scott Fitzgerald's penis and Ford Madox Ford's body odor. The writer Henry Alford thinks this kind of revisionist editing might really catch on.
Everyone's a critic, as some of us know a little too well. But is everyone an editor, too? I recently asked three writers what works of literature need improving. Sandra Singh Lowe, the author of Mother on Fire, told me she loves the book The Bridges of Madison County, the bestseller about an isolated farmer's wife who has an affair with a photographer passing through town. But what happens after the affair gets Sandra's goat? Francesca, who's Italian, stays married to the farmer and stealthily reads letters from the photographer for 22 years and suffers.
Once a year, she takes out those letters and she looks at them on her birthday and she has a bath with a pot of candles and then looks at the photograph of herself and remembers it and then she puts it back in the box till the next year. And at that point, that's just stupid. Who cares? What is she trying to prove at that point by not going off with him?
In Sandra Singh Lowe's version, Francesca would wait till the kids are in college and then ditch her husband. She'd make him an elaborate dinner. And for the kiss-off scene, there would be cobbler.
Would she then say, after the cobbler, she would take him by the hand and say, let's sit on the porch this one last time, and how she would have that conversation with that farmer?
Certainly not in your Italian accent that you're doing.
I think that was a Bangladeshi as a Cockney, I don't know.
In the rewrite, Francesca and the photographer's future would be particularly social.
They're adventurers. You know, now they're 70 and they're just one of those, like, adventurous, but a little vote of candles bath is, like, getting too tedious. And then maybe they would take on another partner or something.
What is happening under those bridges of Madison County?
That's why they're covered. That's why the bridges are covered.
Patricia Marks, who writes for The New Yorker and is the author of the novel Him, Her, Him Again, The End of Him, had an idea for that other famous adulteress, Anna Karenina.
When she meets Vronsky, then she goes home and she's repulsed by the way her husband's ears press against his hat. So,
oh,
see what I mean?
Yeah, that's very precious.
She needs Prozac.
Yeah.
She needs Prozac.
Once Marx had written a prescription and Anna's spirits were lifted, Marx would then tackle the novel's other glaring problem, the character's unnecessarily complicated names.
And I have some new nicknames.
Oh, good. Let's hear them.
Well, Prince Stepan Argidovich Oblonsky.
Uh-huh.
Skip.
Skip. Nice.
Dolly's fine.
You're going with Dolly.
Dolly I'm going to go with. Levin, Kevin maybe. Kevin? Vronsky? Ron? Maybe Ron?
Ron. Well, Ron. You know, I get to page 400 and I thought, oh my God, Alyosha and Vronsky are the same
character. I know, why do they do that?
And maybe more Americans would appreciate Shakespeare's tragedies if you could cut through some of the gloom. Ben Schott, the author of Schott's original Miscellany, has a great idea for King Lear. In his version, Lear acts so crazy because he has a blood disorder, porphyria. Just like another king, in a play by Alan Bennett.
What I wanted to do was to insert a bit of the Madness of King George, have him getting better. Maybe it's all down to porphyria and he gets better.
You could call this porphyria.
I'm speechless.
Once Lear is better, then the real fireworks would begin, with the king going after those baddies, his daughters Goneril and Regan.
I think bloody revenge in a tis pity she's a whore way, where there is, you know, literally blood on the walls.
With a bare bodkin.
With any kind of naked or clothed, frankly. I think if you can find a bodkin these days, you're not going to inquire about its dress condition. No, I'm all in favour of Lear exacting, I think, Gloucester-esque revenge. I think plucking out of eyes. And yeah, I think he should get all Guantanamo on them.
Give an editor an inch and he'll take a mile. Readers of the classics may need to prepare for some rocky terrain ahead. Patricia Marks thinks the only reason anyone finds Anna Karenina at all sympathetic is because they think of the movie. Marks would like to change Anna's name, and indeed the name of the novel, to Greta Garbo. As in Leo Tolstoy's Greta Garbo.
What about potentially confused book buyers who go into the bookstore and see this?
Keep their receipt. Just keep their receipt and they'll be okay.
For Studio 360, I'm Henry Alford.
The delightful Henry Alford's latest book is called How to Live, A Search for Wisdom from Old People While They're Still on This Earth. Studio 360 is produced by PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Alana Harper,
Aaron Calabria,
Susie Karlowski,
Jordan Sale.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, you may know Michael Chabon as the author of The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, but he's also a father of four.
I've begun to have a texting relationship with my kids. I love having that kind of immediate sense of connection. On the other hand, it's a kind of a lowjack.
The writer Michael Chabon takes on parenting. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.